Hey, welcome to Integrating Psychedelics, the podcast. I'm your host, Jenny Wiener. You might know this podcast formerly as Everyday Non-Ordinary. I just changed the name a few weeks ago. I feel like to people who know psychedelics well, the name Everyday Non-Ordinary made sense. I'm talking about psychedelic integration, which is really about taking the experience from these non-ordinary states of consciousness and integrating it into our everyday lives, hence the name Everyday Non-Ordinary. But to a lot of other people, I think it didn't quite make sense or wasn't as clear, especially for people who weren't familiar with it. And I didn't get any feedback specifically to that effect, but it was just kind of the sense I had. And I think this name just makes it easier to find and understand right away what this is about. So that's it for the name change. You might also have noticed, if you're a regular listener, that I have not been posting very consistently. The budget for this show is less than zero, so I do everything myself, and it's just turned out to take a little more time and effort than anticipated and have had the bandwidth for, but just letting myself do it when I can, as I can. It's just something I enjoy right now, and I've gotten a lot of good feedback about and want to keep putting out there, but without the pressure on myself to do it in a certain way or perform a certain way. So thanks if you're still listening and being here, and thanks for your patience. Today, I'm speaking with my friend Ari Barinsky, and I met Ari, like I've met a lot of my guests, in one of my trainings for psychedelic assisted therapy, and he's become a good friend and someone I really just admire working in this space, and was excited to hear more of his story and share that with you. So I will let the interview speak for itself, and I'll catch you on the other side. Hey, Ari, welcome.
Hi, Jenny.
Good to see you.
You too.
So tell me how you found your way to psychedelics. How did you end up in this space?
Sure thing. I knew you would ask me that. So I realized that it's appropriate to start, I guess, talking about like my relationship to cannabis, which of course like is and isn't a psychedelic. But you know, when I was like a teenager, I started smoking weed, and, it took me places, and it connected me with a feeling that I had when I was a kid. Like, it connected me back to the wonderful world of like my imagination. It was problematic at the time because it was very illegal, and I don't come from like a family system where engaging with psychoactive plants or substances is like part of the culture. But it was in many ways a first relationship with a plant and a medicine of sorts that brought me back to some kind of like source or essence. Of course, I didn't realize that when I was 15. And it certainly took me back to like laughter in a like deep and powerful way.
Yeah.
It was like, there was this weird gap where like, you know, in our like sort of like Western cultures, we don't have rites of passage. And so there's no like, you know, I was like bar mitzvahed when I was 13, but that certainly wasn't a delineation, you know, of any real felt sense. It wasn't like, oh yeah, and now I'm a man, and so I have these responsibilities. She's like, no, you're going to continue to be a seventh grader. And so, yeah, but I could feel when I was a teenager, the child in me, I was getting sort of farther, you know, more, it felt more distant because I had like responsibilities, and I was like caring a lot about school and sports, and sort of like smoking weed definitely just gave me breaks, really appreciated breaks from like that felt sense of kind of what in my world was like capital R responsibility. And from that starting point, I connected with friends at school who were also already kind of thinking about actual psychedelics, actually. I mean, we were smoking weed together, but then they seemed to have more mastery of like what was the internet at that point. And there was a website called Arrowid, which is still you know, a website. And I had a friend who just like loved to read articles on Arrowid. And I rarely did it myself. I just sort of learned from him. And he started reading about mushrooms, and mushrooms were available to suburban New Jersey, you know, particularly, you know, the privileged kind of suburban New Jersey background that I came from, where you could like afford them and find them or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I had friends who tried them and I didn't, but they, you know, had they raving sort of, you know, reviews of their experiences. And of course, at that time, it was just all about, it's kind of just all about having fun, you know? And so I found my way to purchasing mushrooms at kind of, technically it was illegal because I was underage, but if I had been 18, I was in Amsterdam. And I bought them from, you know, what used to be called smart shops. I'm not sure what they're called anymore. I participated in this program where I would play tennis tournaments in local European cities over the summers, which, you know, my mom was a professional tennis player and traveled the world and earned a living playing tennis and had me, you know, have a lot of exposure actually to like a, you know, an amateur version of that, when I was in high school. And I just loved it. And, my friend and I did this program together. It's called Tennis Europe. And, we happened to choose the trip that took us to Amsterdam 2 summers in a row. And the second summer I was there, I was like, you know, I gotta find like, yeah, I can just walk into a store and buy mushrooms. Like what? And so I did, and, took them, like kind of didn't, it was like, I had to like sneak away to buy them, and, took them to Paris in my tennis bag. I was like carrying tennis rackets and what at the time they used to sell like wet mushrooms, which they don't sell anymore. And my friend and I ate them in our hotel room and washed them down with like lukewarm ginger ale. And I'll never forget, there were the Smurfs were on in French in our hotel room on this like little TV. And of course, eventually we turned that off, and actually like, you know, nothing was prepared, but, and we didn't know what to expect, but the entire experience ended up, we had it in the dark. Like the lights were out in our room, and we didn't, only when I would get up to go to the bathroom would I be like, oh my God, there's like a world of light in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And I just like, my friend and I laughed on a level that definitely like transcended what I had experienced with marijuana. And we also like created a language that was only mutually intelligible to the two of us in that place and time. And it was very, very beautiful. And like, you know, at one point I like sort of fell off my bed and my tennis racket was under the bed, and there was just like a whole world, you know, that felt so real and fun. And my friend and I were still in touch. And like to this day, you know, like I went to his wedding, and we remember some of the words that we invented with each other. And it's just, it happened to be a very beautiful intro. Of course, like the next day we just sort of like woke up and literally like flew home and just didn't know at all what to do with that, you know, experience. After that, I came back home to New Jersey and then, you know, had other mushroom experiences with my friends that always involved nature, actually. So we would take them out in nature. And that was, you know, mostly like junior and senior year of high school, actually. So I was like 16 and 17. And I got to a place where I thought I wanted to take a little more than what I had been taking. And it ended up being, I guess, you know, looking back, I don't know whether to call it a good or a bad decision, but it definitely, I definitely had what I labeled at the time a bad trip. Mm-hmm. And it scared me so much that I didn't take mushrooms again for 10 years, from 18 to 28. And you know, my friends would find their way to them in college or whatever. And I was like, no, I'm done with that. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of my intro to psychedelics. I guess it's, maybe, you know, somewhat unique, but, there's, you know, there was a lot there.
Yeah. It sounds like accessing joy and humor was a really big part of your entry.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like strengthening and deepening bonds of friendship. There's nothing like sharing those states with people you already have beautiful, deep ties with. You know, that looking back and thinking about it now, it's like, that's the village. You know, your village is like your friends, essentially, at least in the cultural community that I came from, which was one of, I had like a very, very small biological family. And so I've gone about my whole life consciously and unconsciously, like building friendships that are so meaningful that they very much feel like, you know, like family and part of this village, you know, inner world village, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And so, I think about that, of course, in terms of the context that I find myself in now, learning and working with plant medicines, for example, you know, in the Amazon. And one thing that people in the psychedelic, you know, field talk about a lot is the fact that, like, traditionally a medicine like ayahuasca is taken with, of course, like with people that you really know, and you're going to leave ceremony and you're going to go back to your village with them and have a chance to integrate and incorporate that experience into your lives and have access most likely to the shaman to still, you know, ask questions and whatnot. And so, for me and for us, it's like that framework doesn't fit. But what does fit, or what did fit in the past for me and for some of us, is like, I'm going to continue to have relationships with the people that I shared these experiences with. And so that's what it is. You know, that's what's available for continuing to make some sense of the experience with others.
Yeah. That's interesting. I had actually never really thought about that. I also have a pretty small biological family. And I'm sort of thinking now about how that impacts like how I forge relationships and look for community. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it. I've thought a lot about it because I'm very interested in, I guess, what, you know, is called like the field of evolutionary biology, right? And like I read Sapiens, and I think about the extent to which a lot of us live without, we're lacking, so to speak, in terms of a sense of what humans originally were designed for and what kind of hardware and software we're still running around with. You know, just the idea that like the biology hasn't caught up to certainly to the technology and to the lifestyle choices that we're making, you know, and I think there's a lot. I just think there's a lot there, you know, there's a lot to consider there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what happened at 28? How did you find your way back?
Well, I mean, I'll lay it all out. I did find my way to experiencing MDMA. And that was almost always in the context of like a music festival, which is how I guess a lot of people first experience it. And, you know, these terms, even like, I believe MDMA is referred to in the research community as like an empathogen or enactogen or something like that. It's not a traditional psychedelic. And so I was never thinking of it in terms of the, I'm taking a psychedelic right now. I usually just kind of thought of it as like, this is really fun.
Yeah.
And deep, you know? And so, it was sometime around 28. I started to experience chronic lower back pain when I was 26. And that was, it's a big part of my story actually, because, what happened was, so I went into the Peace Corps, if you remember, after college, and, I lived in El Salvador for 2 years and went really, deep into that experience. And struggled a lot when I came home. Really what happened was I repressed a lot, when I came home, and I was really good at repressing. And I decided that I started volunteering at an immigrant resource center in very close to my hometown in New Jersey. And the people that were coming in looking for services, most of them wanted to see the immigration lawyer. And so I was like a philosophy major in college, and found myself actually like taking the LSAT to go to law school in college. But then I like realized that I wasn't prepared for it. So I canceled my score. And I was like, I think I need to like do, you know, more with my body. So I joined the Peace Corps, and that's of course kind of in many ways the polar opposite of going to law school. But I did find myself again being like, I want to connect and help and keep working with immigrant communities. And it looks like the best way to do that is to become an immigration lawyer. And so I started studying seriously for the LSAT, and I got into the law school that I wanted to get into, which had this like immigration justice program in New York City. And I moved to New York City at 26. And a couple weeks into the program, you know, that I was in law school, I had a kind of breakdown essentially, and my repression and depression started to coalesce in such a way that, well, I guess what happened was it stopped working for me, you know, and I dropped out of law school and found myself really lost and really definitely in the midst of my first like major depressive episode of my life, and didn't have language for that. But I did start seeing a psychiatrist, and sort of that ran its course, you know. It was like a proper 6 month deep, painful, life-changing experience in many ways. And when I came out of that mental funk of sorts, I started to experience this back pain, this chronic lower back pain. And so I had this story that a lot of people have with chronic pain, which is they'll see just like every professional under the sun who, you know, says that they have a version of the answer, you know, to help them. And nothing helped really. You know, there were some interventions that provided some temporary relief and stuff like that, but nothing was really getting to the source of that tension. And so I started to read, I found my way to some literature. Do you know who Dr. Sarno is?
I don't.
Dr. John Sarno. Dr. Sarno is a great name actually for mental health professionals, I think, to know. He's on my, when I meet new clients, I'll send them like a recommended like resource and reading list. And one of his books is on that list. It's called like it's his last book that I recommend. The Divided Mind is what it's called.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, he was a medical doctor working at NYU from the 60s until he died like a couple years ago. And his, you know, discovery had everything to do with the fact that a lot of people are stuck in patterns of chronic physical pain because of deep, repressed, underlying psychological trauma. And this was and is a very controversial thing to say when you're a medical doctor. And so he did a lot of research and has a lot of, you know, studies to back up this claim. And there's a great video on YouTube, by the way, where he's actually, he makes his way to a committee hearing in front of politicians in Washington. And he's looking for more funding into sort of like mind-body disorders from, I think, NIH, something like that. And there's a senator who's asking him questions on the stand about his research and his theories. And it's unbelievable. Bernie Sanders is there also. And he has this central Bernie Sanders moment where he's asking good questions. And there are some other doctors who are there like refuting these ideas and stuff. But the twist in this hearing is that the senator who's asking Dr. Sarna the questions reveals that he himself was like a phone call away from having like some kind of like fusion surgery for his back because nothing was helping his chronic lower back pain. When a friend handed him, this senator, one of Dr. Sarna's books, like the original book, I think, called Healing Back Pain. And this senator read the book and met with Dr. Sarna and started to feel better and didn't do the surgery and didn't become another one of these case studies where people do some kind of unnecessary surgery based on some kind of MRI or whatever. And anyway, so this senator is like a big fan, you know, of Dr. Sarna, and as is Howard Stern and like a couple of like sort of like celebrity people that have found their way to his work because they've struggled in their lives with chronic back pain. And I found Dr. Sarna's work and started to become curious about, I was depressed and now I'm not really depressed, but my back is killing me. So like, what's going on? Like, and I started to at least consider the idea that there was a psychophysiological connection here. And that took me, you know, got me back interested in psychedelics and it definitely was the catalyst. I was still experiencing quite a lot of pain when I found my way to Peru for the first time, an ayahuasca retreat. And so, had it not been for the pain, I definitely wouldn't have been sort of bold enough to just get on a plane by myself. Because at that point, nobody in my inner circle had worked with ayahuasca, and I wasn't. I was like just out of grad school, working in very traditional, working for a psychiatrist, in a very traditional, you know, medical model kind of setting. Mm-hmm. But when you're in pain, and this of course rings true for mental anguish as well. I mean, people will, you know, the human will is such that, we're going to do kind of anything to try to not be in pain anymore. And so my real healing journey with my back and it began when I committed essentially to going to Peru, to work with ayahuasca, and I'm still on that healing journey. But I'm doing so well, like so well. And the days that I have when my back actually like hurts, they're so few. So yeah, that's a version of that story.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I didn't know that about the pain, the chronic pain part of your story. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can say a little more about what you see as the interplay between how your work with psychedelics has helped that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's the peak experience, so to speak, of being on the medicine. So there's a before and after for me with my pain and with I guess my life in many ways. And it was my third ayahuasca ceremony where I was sort of bold enough to go up and take the second cup. Cause in the tradition, in a lot of traditions in Peru, they will offer a second cup after about like an hour and a half into ceremony. And sort of like the more intrepid pasajeros, the passengers, the people that are there, they'll go up and take it. But the first two nights I didn't take it because I didn't think I needed it, essentially. And I was still kind of afraid. And so that third ceremony was, I experienced a version of what I call like an exorcism. I physically was like gyrating, essentially, uncontrollably. And I was getting images of kind of like unwinding my back in kind of like a corkscrew kind of fashion. And of course I was like screaming and I don't know, you know, what all of a sudden people were around me trying to help me. And the main reason that I was just as an aside, the main reason that I was, bold enough to ask this for the second cup that night is because there was another person in the ceremony room, a Russian pasajero who went up and drank a full cup that night. And apparently there's like the Russians are known for going big. And very quickly into the beginning of ceremony, he started howling like a wolf. Not like a wolf. He became a wolf.
Right.
And I was like, oh man, I'm going to have to take some more tonight because this guy's on a level and I'm not. And I, you know, I waited like an appropriate amount of time or whatever. And so I went up for that second cup. But, so whatever happened during that ceremony, I definitely know that something shifted. But truthfully, it was a long time after that. You know, when I came back home, and this is very relevant, I think, to everything we want to talk about with respect to integration, because this was, I came back home from that experience and did integration wrong. I could trademark some kind of website, like doingintegrationwrong.org, make it a charity of sorts, because... I had nothing in mind and so my pain came back. My pain went away for the most part after that exorcism, and we had one more ceremony, and I had like two more nights, you know, I had like one or two more nights in the jungle at some like, you know, basic hotel that they tell you to go to in Iquitos, which is sort of like the, you know, the capital of ayahuasca, the ayahuasca world in Peru. And I flew home and immediately went to work on Monday. I think I flew home and got home like literally on a Sunday morning and went to work on Monday. And of course, synchronistically, I was supervising an intern at the time, like my first intern. And there had been an issue with the intern when I was away. And my coworker was presenting me, he reeled me into a work-related situation that I didn't want anything to do with. I wouldn't have wanted anything to do with it before the ayahuasca retreat, but at this point I was like, whoa, I really can't handle this right now and don't think it's like even like appropriate anyway, but I was in it. And it was very destabilizing for me. And also that week I went and had a dinner with my sister, and she brought a particular energy. You know, the thing that some of us forget when we have like a retreat experience or powerful psychedelic experience is that you come back into the world and like these people weren't there. They really weren't there, you know, and they've never been there, a lot of them, you know. And so I was sort of, I was ambushed by my sister at this sushi dinner, because I was not interested in going to some kind of family, you know, vacation that she really wanted. She was like, how could you not go to this and all this stuff? And I was just like, oh my God, like the timing of all this stuff was felt so intense and powerful, you know, for me. And it really just all the magic and the healing very quickly, I could feel it just fading The one resource and important element of the integration process that I was able to attach to after that experience was that I stayed in touch with one other pasajero who also lived in New York City. Like I did enough connecting to be like, okay, there's one other person here in the middle of the jungle having this experience, and he lives in New York City, and we connected a little bit. So let's stay in touch, right? And he was like the only person at that point in my life that I could talk to about this stuff and try to, you know, make any sense of, but it really wasn't enough. And so most of my pain came back, but it had like a lot of people talk about who are experiencing some kind of pain, mental, physical, spiritual, whatever, and then have at least some moments of, you know, reprieve from that pain. It gives them hope. It just gives them not the kind of hope we like talk about in therapy, the hope that you feel, you know, it's a sensory experience. You're like, right. There's life without back pain. Right. I just had it for a little bit. I remember that, you know, and then there's motivation, and then there's effort, and you know, all the pieces can slowly fall into play after you have some direct contact with the sensory experience, I guess, of hope.
Right. Yeah. It opens up the door to the possibility of feeling that way, existing that way again.
For sure.
Yeah. For sure. And what would you have done differently in terms of integration?
I mean, I actually definitely would have stayed in Peru a little longer on the tail end of that experience, because, you know, it was a 4-ceremony retreat, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And I'm pretty sure I came back Sunday morning. And what that, you know, even just like three, the tricky thing with this particular medicine, if people are going to that area of the jungle, is that the city that you fly in and out of, Iquitos, is notorious for being a difficult place to hang out after deep medicine work, because it's very chaotic, it's very hot, and ultimately it really is, unless, you know, I have a better relationship with that city now, and I know how to feel safe there, essentially. But if it's your first time there, and I was, you know, I had already lived in Latin America and I speak Spanish, and I'm like, you know, thinking I'll just be fine. Like I can, you know, I can get by anywhere in Latin America, but you're no longer getting by after an experience like that. You know, you're to a certain extent in pieces in different ways, you know, or just feeling very, very vulnerable. So, I would have done what I've subsequently done, which is had a plan for where I'm going to go in Peru and chill out for a couple days. You know, some people, it doesn't have to look like that. Of course, some people maybe can come back to their home, you know, country, but maybe not go straight back to their house, right? Maybe have a plan in place for like being in nature if they don't live in nature. I think ultimately I would say, in my opinion, it's best to just be elsewhere, actually, even if you do live in some idyllic cottage, you know, in the woods with fairies and loved ones. I think it's helpful to not have to be presented with associations that we have with places, you know, and energy. So I definitely would have left some more time on the tail end of that trip. And now I have a go-to eco-tourism, you know, center, where if I want, I can go there after a retreat. And it's like further down the river, and it's very beautiful. And like the people working there understand that some of the guests are showing up after having had very deep experiences with ayahuasca. And so, you know, the vibes are right and all that stuff. That's one thing I would have done. I also, you know, I wasn't in therapy at the time, if I recall, and I didn't have a sense of, other than this one friend who I happened to make, I just didn't have a plan for, like, you know, I didn't have a plan for what am I going to do on an individual level with myself to integrate this experience, and I didn't have a plan on a communal level. You know, how am I going to use my words as best as I can to share. And so, you know, I had mostly nothing, I guess, you know, I just had a kind of confidence in, or naivete really about what was going to transpire afterwards.
It can be such a rude awakening. You know, I just got back from another ketamine therapy training, and we met in a CAP training, and you know, the like sacred container of those spaces. And towards the end of this training, people were sort of lamenting, like having to go back to real life, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And we were lucky to be studying there with Dick Schwartz, founder of Internal Family Systems. And he offered this beautiful reminder. He was like, this is real life. Mm-hmm. And I love this idea that, yeah, like in like real life doesn't require all of the sort of mechanisms of integration and trying so hard. We shouldn't have to try so hard to be okay, you know? And I don't know, for me, sort of that flipping that was really helpful.
I love that.
Like, yeah, no, I need all this support and all these tools to handle this other thing that's like not real life. It's this thing we created.
That comment or commentary makes me think of something that came up in one of the lectures. I'm currently taking a 12-month psychedelic therapy course that's put on by the people who run Psychedelics Today.
Oh yeah.
The vital training. And I'm really loving it. And one of the lecturers talked about, in discussing integration, he mentioned something like, you know, he thinks that the task, if we could consider reversing the order here. So like, how do we integrate regular sober life into the psychedelic experience, right? Not struggle so much and have so much effort involved in, like, you know, the opposite of that, which is like, how do I keep that psychedelic experience alive, right? You know, it's more like, how do I make my regular waking life feel on some level more psychedelic, which of course in the original sense, right? Not like I'm walking around tripping, but just like I'm letting my soul manifest.
Right. Well, and it is psychedelic, our everyday lives. So how do we access that more readily and feel into that? And it's like, if you fine tune the frequency just right, like you can access it, but it's brief, you know?
That's the language that I'm using now, you know, with my CAP clients, and with myself, the tuning, actually. I heard somebody just talking about how meditation is a technique for tuning one's instrument, and one's instrument is, you know, one's body, essentially, mind, body, spirit, you know. And you know, I play the guitar, and I know what it feels like to, and I play the piano, and I know what it feels like to play an out of tune instrument, and it's awful. Yeah. And I really liked that analogy of just like, huh, turns out that if you can manage to sit for any amount of time, you know, and breathe, then we're tuning, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned your CAP practice. How did you find your way there?
I had signed up for the training that you and I met at, like as early as I could. I think it was supposed to be in April of 2020. And of course, it wasn't. Right. And, you know, I struggled a lot with, during the pandemic, with feeling like a lot of things that I had been looking forward to were essentially just taken away. Mm-hmm. You know, but to the spectrum of that statement, of course, runs the gamut from like people dying from COVID in my immediate work community, because I was working at a clinic in Queens, like a block away from like the hardest hit hospital at the time, all the way to just like my own somewhat, you know, like myopic, like personal world of like, oh, and you're not going to get to do that. And you're not going to get to do this. And, you know, and then you're going to sit, you know, and you just went through a breakup and you're going to sit alone in your apartment, or, you know, with your cat and have to deal with that. You, mm-hmm. you, and, and, And so it was very destabilizing, and I definitely, you know, experienced at that point, like, my second major depressive episode. And it was harder in so many ways than the first one, because the first one, after law school, I could just, like, sleep in my apartment, and sort of, you know, the backdrop to that was like, oh, he came back from the Peace Corps and he doesn't know what he wants to do in his life. And he, you know, just like, let's, you know, have some time, essentially just dedicate some time to figuring it out. But I didn't have that luxury this time, because I was working, you know, I was experiencing deep imposter syndrome, by having to be a therapist, hold space for others who are depressed, who are having suicidal ideation, while all that's happening in my inner world as well. And yeah. So that was something that was truly an incredibly challenging, you know, time for me. And I, luckily, you know, I worked through it again. And I was lucky enough to find my way, through a series of synchronicities, get connected with a plant medicine community, more local. And that, you know, connection has helped me tremendously, actually. And now I'm involved with, volunteering up there and, you know, holding space for others. So I, you know, I was able to just hold on to essentially, long enough to make it to the CAP training where you and I met, you know, with Phil. And of course I, like, felt super ready to do the work once we were trained in it, and then experienced what some of us non-prescribers experience, which is like, oh wait, I actually can't do this because I don't have a, you know, a nurse practitioner or a physician, partner at this time. And it took, you know, many months, to find out, you know, like we were discussing before, I linked up with this awesome ketamine startup called Journey Clinical, and I'm very grateful for that partnership. And I also stayed in touch with some people we met at our training, you know, Nika and Ben, who are, at the time, you know, Nika was involved in Field Trip Health. And so I still have a partnership with Field Trip Health, which is the clinic in Manhattan where they offer intramuscular ketamine. Right. And I've taken a couple clients into their facility to guide them through IM ketamine sessions. Every time I've gone in, there's been this voice in the back of my head saying, this is not actually how you want to work with the medicine, because there's a real middleman here. And I don't think it's ideal for the healing process, essentially. And so now with Journey, my clients get their own prescription and comes to their home, and they bring in their lozenges, and we, you know, we do this work in a much more contained, what I feel like is a contained, intentional kind of way, even. Mm-hmm. Not that the experiences that people have at, you know, at Field Trip, they benefit from them for sure, but it's just not my particular, my preference for working with ketamine.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you bring a particular framework to integration with your clients, or is it just really sort of individual?
It does vary, actually. But I do encourage people to think about mind, body, spirit. I use that language. And inevitably people are going to have they're gonna be more comfortable navigating maybe one or two of those realms. You know, a lot of, for example, I work with some, you know, young professionals who are up in their heads, you know, a lot, you know, and this is sort of the thing that, you know, you and I hear, of course, with clients, maybe of all ages, you know, but there seems to be something particularly millennial, in my opinion, about this tendency to just over intellect, you kind of like use the intellect as a defense mechanism almost, and just stay in the world of, you know, an analysis, essentially, because mostly because, it's helped them so much in their careers.
Right.
You know, and so the crux of the psychedelic experience, you know, has very little to do with that left brain experience. You know, the monkey mind will come back online at some point. And I guess our task as, you know, therapists and integration guides is to help people make some space for continuing to disengage, essentially, I would say. And a great way to do that is through some kind of mind-body practice, right? Or to encourage people to, at times, connect with spirit and define that, and you know, for themselves. Which, again, some people are already kind of rolling, you know, with that kind of stuff. And others really need to learn what that might look like for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and be given permission to shape for them, like whatever that means.
Permission. That's the magic. That's my magic word relating to all things psychedelic, really. It came to me at a San Pedro retreat in the Sacred Valley in Peru. I took that medicine and I just... that it's like that word emanated from my being. And I was so grateful that I had it and that people around me had permission to be in that state and to feel their feelings, you know, and to let their feelings come out in the form of, for me, you know, communing with a bumblebee in one of the gardens and rolling around on the grass. And walking this like beautiful maze that was part of this, you know, chakra garden at this retreat center that I was at. And so, yeah, permission is permission. I think about and talk about like permission, and then like devotion is a word that comes up that was gifted to me when I was having a really hard time during the pandemic. And I was having a conversation with a person involved with the plant medicine community upstate. You know, and I was sort of on this rant of discussing all the things that have been taken away from me during the pandemic. And he just sort of had me pause and he was like, yeah, a lot of people are, you know, kind of in that space too. And, you know, I wonder if you, given that so much is not available, could you think about what is going on and available and accessible and be more intentional in the way you relate to what is available. And he said, you know, one way to do that is through like the devotional practices of sorts, you know, and essentially it's a, you know, I've thought about it. It's another word for, I guess it's a more sort of religious or spiritual word for this term that's been a buzz in our field, which is mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, can you be present and at least on some minuscule level, transcend even, you know, I mean, that's a big word. So I don't always use that, that language with clients for integration work, but devotion I do use, meaning like, instead of just mindlessly wandering through our days and our tasks and particularly the things we're not liking, you know, the activities we find ourselves engaging with or the relationships we have that are difficult, you know, are there moments when we can consider them in terms of, oh yeah. I mean, it works particularly well for things you do by yourself, like making your bed, like chores, you know, and what it could mean is like, you know, it could mean that this practice is a part of a system, you know, that is somehow related to your healing journey. You know, not... that language, healing journey, is familiar to you, of course, and to people in our, you know, our field and in the psychedelic world. It's very much not a part of everyday language for, I think your average human. You know, they're not interested even in framing their life in those terms, you know. But it's super relevant.
I rolled my eyes so hard at words like that, you know, a few years ago and until I was really in this space and seeing it, like the healing literally unfold for myself, for other people working with medicines. It's like that same thing we were talking about, the difference in the experiential piece of it and actually feeling it and seeing it. It's like until you've had that, it's hard to believe.
Super hard. Yeah. I wonder what we can do about that. Can't just, you know, this is not 1968. We're not just going to dose everybody. No, we're not putting LSD in the Kool-Aid.
No, not a good idea.
Yeah. I don't know what we can do about it. What I would like to do about it, at least in my sort of, you know, on a micro level, is get to into a practice where at least I can start offering group sessions, you know. Mm-hmm. Have you been involved with any group work around CAP?
I haven't facilitated any. I participated in some groups in this recent training I did, this sort of experimental format with low doses of intramuscular ketamine, followed by processing specifically in the IFS model. And it was amazing. I mean, wow. We were also lucky to be, the groups were facilitated by Dick Schwartz, but who, you know, who's just a master and an IFS ninja and just like cut through within minutes to the heart of things with such kindness and grace. And but it was really breathtaking and mind blowing, the things that people processed and in some cases healed like within a few minutes.
Wow.
So yeah. The potential is there for sure.
Yeah, there's nothing like that. I mean, I did a year training in sensory motor psychotherapy, you know, which is super similar to like somatic experiencing and just sort of like a foundational modality in somatic psychotherapy. And the presenter had a volunteer from, you know, a therapist come up to do a demonstration session. And like, I felt it, like the room melted away and she was there as a client, this therapist, and they went deep, you know, and we saw the power of the intervention and the modality. And so there's nothing quite like that.
And set and setting, of course, right? Like really creating the container makes it possible.
It's everything. And that's another consideration or sort of piece that is so hard for somebody who's not familiar with psychedelics to wrap their head around, you know, because their only experience that they've had with medicine has been, you know, I take this pill and it doesn't matter if I'm on the top of Kilimanjaro or if I'm in my living room, it's going to have the same effect, you know? And so, yeah, that's another one of those, you have to experience it to understand it, I think. And I don't have any grand ideas about how we get more people towards, you know, leaning towards the experiencing, but we're in it.
Is there anything else you're feeling called to share or that you wanted to say today?
I mean, I think just you and I definitely talked about this when I met you. So in terms of just my work here in New York, like I'm in the process of getting a group practice together that's going to be based around CAP and hopefully also definitely incorporating psilocybin and MDMA when we're allowed to do so. And I'm super excited actually to come full circle with my Amsterdam mushroom story. I actually was just in Amsterdam on vacation and like 2 weeks ago, and I stepped into the smart shop where I bought the mushrooms 20 years ago.
Oh my God.
Still there in the same place. And a lot of laws have changed in the Netherlands around selling, you know, psilocybin containing mushrooms. They actually don't, what they sell now are truffles.
Right.
But I just like had a conversation with the guy. I was like, you know, I was here 20 years ago and this is what, you know, and the guy was like, oh man, like that's so cool. And, but I'm going to be going back to the Netherlands at the end of September for a training that's part of this vital psychotherapy, you know, year-long training that I'm doing. And that was a huge, basically the main reason that I was attracted to this training program is because I knew I would have the opportunity to get a retreat experience where we learn to guide with psilocybin, at least, you know, for a couple days. And so I'll be doing that in at the end of September. And then of course, coming back home and just like waiting, you know, like everybody else with a license who isn't, you know, working underground, you know, waiting to have access to that medicine. And also I have this back burner plan, which was more like a front burner plan when you and I met, to have a partnership, with a center somewhere in Latin America, you know, a plant medicine center, and to offer retreat experiences, definitely for mental health professionals. You know, one of the things I realized at the training that where you and I met was just like, there is interest, you know, in, traditional uses of sacred medicines, and a lot of people, especially like medical doctors with like, you know, with a lot to lose, so to speak, in terms of license, you know, their license and all the legal considerations, right? They don't know where to go, and they're not 28-year-old me with chronic back pain who's just going to get on a flight and, you know, and go to Peru, right? And so, I think that it is important for those of us, you know, that are going to be getting trained and working in Western, somewhat under the umbrella of the medical model, I think it is important for a lot of us to have experiences with traditional uses of psychedelics, and it's so real in these communities, you know, in particularly in the Amazon basin. And now, of course, that work is actually being done, you know, in other Latin American countries. And I know of communities that I know in Portugal, everything's decriminalized. You're allowed to go and have ceremony there. And so, yeah, I definitely just have this vision to get a kind of center, you know, organized and oriented in such a way that I can be there a couple times a year, at the, you know, definitely with mental health professionals who want to have that experience, holding space for them, working with indigenous shamans, and then figuring out a way, of course, for everybody to integrate together, you know, when it's over. So it's going to be something that I now realize is like deeply tied into, you know, my life's work. I'm just trying to be patient with it and, make the right kind of connections. And, that's a plan though.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How can people get in touch or stay up on these plans as they unfold?
I don't have a personal website. I just have my, people can find me on Psychology Today and psychedelic.support. But I will have a group practice website, once I figure that out for CAP. And then, you know, so I have this idea to be very public about, of course, this work, especially since everything we're talking about is entirely legal in abroad. And so one idea that came from the training was like, oh, I definitely need to make this available for mental health professionals. And then another idea is, well, I'm going to have this group practice with ketamine, and some of the clients that show up to do the work in Brooklyn might also be interested in a retreat experience, especially with people who are, you know, going to be able to come back to the same city and potentially integrate together. So I would also definitely like to make it available, and we'll have it publicized on whatever that website looks like, you know, for the group practice.
Well, I will definitely come to your retreats for mental health professionals.
Yeah. It's going to be good. We just need, you know, the pandemic to chill out and, you know, Earth to get on board, you know.
Yeah.
Earthlings. Yeah, I'm really excited about all of that. I have ideas, and I used to always say in Queens with my client population there, two steps forward, one step back is how it would sound in English. It sounds better in Spanish. But we're you know, it's moving along. So I will keep you posted. Yeah. And of course all the, you know, the community around our training group, you know, y'all will be the, you'll be the first to know.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing and for this opportunity. And, yeah, I look forward to, seeing who else you're going to, who else you're going to have on. Because I've definitely enjoyed the interviews I've listened to so far.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Ari.
Thanks so much.
So that's the show. Thanks so much for listening. If you've been enjoying the podcast or liked this episode, it would mean a lot if you could leave a 5-star rating or a nice review or just hit the subscribe button. Any of these ways of showing your support goes a long way. Feel free to reach out if there's someone you'd like to see on the podcast, or if you have a, you know, particular framework for integration you're interested in sharing. I'd love to explore that with you. So that's it for now. And I have do have a few more episodes in the pipeline, so hopefully I'll be getting those to you soon. Thanks for listening.